Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm joined by my dad, John Wyatt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And today's conversation is going to be inspired by an essay that I think you found, didn't you, on Substack? Where else these days do you find thought-provoking writing on the internet? By a chap called Paul Schaefer.
Jeff Schaefer, who is a legal scholar in the States and who wrote a paper called Machine Anti-Humanism and the Inversion of Family Law, which expresses ideas which we've talked about before, and certainly ideas that I've been reflecting on, you know, for 20 years plus. But nonetheless, I think he expresses it in a very thought-provoking and quite a profound way, which I felt was worth highlighting so other people can go and read the essay, but also raises a number of very interesting issues to do with the nature of the relationship between children and parents and the role of the state.
And Schaefer's begins his essay by talking about how he was kind of inspired by some news stories and headlines that we've actually mentioned on this podcast before, in particular one about an American tech startup that offers genetic testing of human embryos before they are re-implanted for IVF to check their IQ levels, so that the owners of these embryos can select which one of them to gestate and which ones to discard based on their forecasted intelligence. And we picked up on that story a few months ago in an episode about the surprising return of so-called liberal eugenics. And then the second news story, which caught his eye and kind of prompted his essay, had this headline, quote, "I caught our surrogate drinking alcohol and made her abort the baby," end quote. So what does Schaefer do with these kind of seeds that have been planted in his mind from these slightly alarming headlines?
Well, he reflects on the fact that there's been such a vast change in our attitudes to children, which has all flown from technological developments, assisted reproductive technology. But that sometimes what happens is the technology is so powerful and so all-consuming that we fail to grasp quite what a sea change has taken place in some fundamental psychological, philosophical, and spiritual attitudes about the nature of the family. And so he says, if you go back historically, we've always recognized, he says that the law has deferred to the natural family, and as he puts it, the anthropological depths that the family represents and anchors in society.
And so basically the point he's trying to make is that there is a way that children come into the world that it, is grounded in our biology and how humans reproduce. And for thousands and thousands of years, human society has been forced to defer to the kind of, this is normative, this is the way things are, that a man and a woman have sex, their sperm and egg are fertilized inside her womb, the child grows and is born by that mother and then lives and is grown and is raised by them, this man and woman, as their parents. And that is just taken for granted. And the law and the state, as they came to develop over thousands of years, had to defer to that as this embodied reality. This is normative.
Yeah, that in traditional society, no child is a kind of free-floating singleton. You know, the first question is, you know, well, who do you come from? Whose father? Who is your father? Who is your mother? I mean, you see that in the Bible, don't you? So the most important thing is to establish the genealogy, to establish, you know, where
do you belong to?
Who do you belong to? Whose root are you? And both the mother and the father, certainly in Jewish thinking, are both extremely important because they define who you are. And of course, the whole thing about who Jesus is and the nature of the Messiah and the Son of David and This is a very profoundly rooted in what our understanding of what it means to be human. But it's not just a biblical concept. I think it's a concept of all societies in the past.
I mean, think of how many cultures have developed naming conventions based on who your parents are. You know, think of how many English surnames end with son at the end, S-O-N. But then, you know, I think of an Icelandic to this day, your surname is literally, you know, John's son, or if you're a girl, John's daughter. And that's true across hundreds and hundreds of cultures. People have intuited very deep on a deep level that your identity is in somehow tied to who your parents are, who your kin are, who your family is, where you come from, because it's obvious that a child is intrinsically relational. They don't arrive, as you say, as a free-floating singleton, as a kind of separate, atomized individual in a sea of individuals, but they come through a family.
Of course, the ancient world was never naive about the possibility that the person who thought he was the father might not be the father. I mean, you know, it's the plot of ancient Greek tragedies, Oedipus, and, you know, so
Zeus is constantly impregnating people secretly, isn't he, and all the other stuff.
So in other words, you know, there's never been a naivety about the sort of simple triad of mummy, daddy and a baby. But nonetheless, you know, even in these cases of disputed paternity, it mattered who your real father was. So the identity of the child was always tied up. And that this is something, you know, what Schaefer argues, I think quite rightly, is that this is profoundly important to our own understanding of our humanity. This is what it means to be a human person. Again, this is a theme we've come back before, but I found it very profound that human personhood, this idea that we're constituted by our relations. We're not these monads, these single electrons that just do our own thing, but we're locked into relationships.
And many people point that back to the Trinity and say that that's fundamental because we're built, we're designed, we're created in the image of a relational God, a social God, a single God who yet somehow paradoxically, mysteriously contains within the Godhead three distinct persons in this divine kind of Trinity dance of love that they've been in for eternity past. And so humans, by definition, because we're made in the image of that relational God, cannot be these atomized individuals.
Absolutely. And I think that is such a profound and unique phenomenon of Trinitarian Christianity. You know, many people think it's just bizarre and an unnecessary doctrine, the doctrine of the Trinity. But actually, you know, as many theologians, and I agree, would argue that this is absolutely constitutive of our understanding of what it means to be human, this relationality which comes all the way from the three-in-one Godhead who creates us.
And as Schaefer points out, this is intrinsic to child rearing as well, because it's not just that children are born into a family, but children literally look like their biological parents. You know, we are not only made in the image of our God, our invisible spirit God, but we're also literally made in the image of our mother and father. And we understand the mechanism today. It's, you know, genes and that kind of thing. But you know, as Schaefer writes, children will express in their visibility the bond and resemblances with the mother and father from whom they sprang and to whom they are indelibly connected.
That's right. And also this understanding of the importance of rootedness of our biological kinship and so on. This helps explain why we see an orphan who's lost both parents as somebody in a very tragic situation. Why we take the whole process of adoption and recognize that adoption causes, as he puts it, a grievous loss. You know, it allows us as a society to say that fathers should take responsibility, including financial responsibility, for the children that they fathered. All of these things depend on this deeper philosophical understanding of heredity and kinship.
And yet Schaefer's argument is then that modern technology from the second half of the 20th century onwards, as we started to delve into test tube babies and IVF and gamete donation, and we had a richer, deeper understanding of what was going on at a microscopic level inside human beings when they reproduced, but also began to be able to manipulate and control that for the first time in human history, we no longer defer automatically to the kind of created order of things, but we start to meddle, and that has placed the state in the unorthodox position of having to regulate and decide who a child's real mother is, who they should live with, in a way that is, he would argue, quite troubling.
Yeah, and this is one of the fascinating themes, you know, which we constantly recur around, and that is nobody sat down in the middle of the 20th century and thought, you know, how can I subvert family relations? You know, what kind of devious plan can I come up with to challenge this? No, what happened was a bunch of doctors and technical experts were just trying to solve a medical problem, the problem of infertility. And they came up with a technology involving taking sperm and creating embryos in the laboratory and then reimplanting it. And they saw this as a wonderful solution, medical solution, to a particular problem of infertility. And it's only, you know, that a technology which has unintended consequences. No, who can foresee the amazing ripple of effects which span out from some innocent technological development, quote.
Hmm. Particularly when our kind of modern capitalist industrial society gets its hands on it. Because I imagine the doctors and researchers who invented IVF back in the 60s were imagining this would be a kind of small-scale bespoke service for a small number of couples who were infertile, and they didn't foresee that it would become kind of industrialized and commercialized. And by the 21st century, there would be a possibility of people who are perfectly fertile, but just don't want to do quote unquote kind of traditional procreation. And so instead will pay people at various points to donate either sperm or eggs or both. They will could pay for someone else to donate their womb to be as the surrogate and to abstract yourself from the entire process of bearing children.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's not quite that simple, because actually science fiction had got there first. I mean, just think of Aldous Huxley in Brave New World.
No,
I mean,
that's true. He was writing in the 1930s, wasn't he?
He's already there. He's
industrialized, you know, vats producing children in test tubes. Yeah, no, very prescient.
So as so often, you know, it's science fiction that plays this what if game, and it's decades before the actual technology catches up. But so I think you can overstate perhaps the insouciance of the technologists. I think they were aware that they were doing something groundbreaking and potentially life-changing. But nonetheless, I think it's fascinating to see how things then evolve. So here is where there's a big difference between the UK, which is, of course, actually where the first IVF child was born in the UK, and the States. So what happens in the UK is that there's a very strong drive right from the beginning to regulate this new technology. And in the British way, there are royal commissions and inquiries, and then the Human Fertilization and Embryology Act is created fairly rapidly in order to regulate not only the process of IVF, but what happens to embryos in labs, who's allowed to have do embryo research, what's the legal basis, how long can you keep an embryo in a lab, all these kind of things have been regulated top down. And perhaps not surprisingly, this doesn't happen in the States, which has a much more libertarian, small state approach. Mm.
And also it reflects the differing healthcare systems as well, in that by the time IVF is conceived, the UK has already had a kind of top-down bureaucratic state-run publicly funded single national health service. And therefore there's a kind of, obviously you can still go private if you want, and there are lots of private fertility clinics out there, but there is a kind of tendency for the kind of medical scientific establishment to lean towards greater regulation and bureaucracy, whereas America has a freewheeling, free market, individualistic health insurance based model, and as well as, you know, a federal system of 50 different states with their own legal jurisdictions. And so, of course, it becomes very, very fragmented and in many places almost completely unregulated.
That's right. And my understanding is that at a federal level, the US government would only control US-funded research. So NIH research was closely scrutinized and regulated. But in terms of private, commercially funded activities, the default position, I think, in the US has been to allow the market to operate unless it's very clear that it's causing harm. And so really quite rapidly, I think, commercial markets in both sperm and egg donation and in surrogate mothers developed. And, you know, you can go onto the internet and you can find sperm banks in the States where you can choose what kind of donor you want. You can choose, you know, their, not only their hair color and racial origin, but you can choose, you know, have they got a PhD, you know. So the highest value, I think, as one might predict, is for the men, is that they, male sperm donors, is that they have a PhD, are musical and sporty. You know, if you can combine all those three with athleticism, musical ability and high IQ, academic achievement, then your sperm, you know, comes out pretty high. And for the women, you have to be blonde and tall and slim, in addition to having a PhD.
Of course. Kelsey Preece. Yeah. And Schaefer talks about this, you know, about how there's an entire assisted reproductive technology, ART, industry, you know, with these catalogues of men and women who are offering up their sperm or eggs for sale. But there's also, you know, then, as he puts it, the lab creation of batches of embryos for eugenic sorting. You know, so that's, you know, in IVF, we, you know, as we talked many times before, part of the process is to kind of cause super ovulation. So to use artificial drugs to prompt the woman to release more eggs than usual, to kind of boost the chances of getting as many embryos in the test tube as possible, of whom only one or two will probably ever be re-implanted and grow to become children. But also surrogacy contracts, which again is another part where the UK is very tightly regulated, and we've done a whole episode about surrogacy, and you can scroll back to find that if you're interested. We'll put a link in the show notes. But, you know, it's very tightly regulated and has to be kind of, it's only allowed to be done on kind of altruistic, non-commercial grounds in the UK, whereas in the States, in many individual states, it's a complete Wild West, and it's very commonplace for it to be an entirely commercial process with a middleman, a broker who's getting paid, finding the surrogate, and then the intended commissioning parents not only pay the surrogate and the broker, but they also literally sign a contract dictating the terms, what you can and can't do while you're pregnant, how the handover will work once the child is born, et cetera, et cetera.
And of course, we also have this phenomenon of reproductive tourism. So many surrogate mothers are actually in low resource, poor countries. And it's interesting that the article is headlined with a photograph, a famous photograph from the time of the onset of the Ukraine war, which is of a nursery in Ukraine with a whole series of babies who were apparently the abandoned babies of surrogate pregnancies, who the commissioning parents were abroad and were not able to come to Ukraine to pick up their babies. And so this presented a very, in a very stark way, the fundamental issue that these children, who do they belong to? What is their identity? How, as this child grows, how is this child going to understand who they are?
And who is going to look after them? You know, the question of who will look after this child, because as we know, children are unique among mammals, are born intensely vulnerable physically and emotionally and remain so for upwards of 18 years before they can look after themselves. So they're deeply in need of an adult human to care for them, if not to. And who's going to look after them? You know, the surrogate mothers who have carried these children have no intention or desire or ability or funds to raise these children. The commissioning parents are marooned out of the world, and maybe they've moved on. And so these children are kind of almost born parentless.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
The argument of the essay is that in this vacuum where it is not clear who this child is, it is not clear who is responsible, the argument goes that the state has to step in. There is no alternative. The state has to determine the identity and the responsibility of the child, and that therefore there is a kind of huge potential here for a totalitarian control. Instead of the family now being defined by who your mother and father are, it's the state that makes the decision. It's the state that defines who you are. And there is this, you know, the state then intrudes into these most profound nature of the nature of our humanity.
Mm. Schaefer writes this: where the law coordinates this commerce in persons, it teaches that the existence of a child is a legal problem for state resolution rather than a pre-existing relational truth that the state must acknowledge and defer to.
Yeah, and so, I mean, that's the essence of the argument. I suppose it clearly, if one takes the kind of extreme version of this reproductive tourism, as we saw in Ukraine and so on, it's pretty obvious to see the profound problems and challenges that it raises. I suppose that, you know, if one was to push back, you know, what about two sisters who, you know, one sister who is infertile, the other sister who is wishing to help? Why don't we just have an agreement between us? Maybe nobody need know, or you know, or maybe we'll regularize it. But basically, I will be impregnated by your embryo, and when the baby's born, I'll pass the embryo back, and it's all within the family. And how do you feel about surrogacy like that? Would you say it's always wrong, or that there are situations where it might be acceptable?
It's a very good question. I think clearly that form of kind of purely altruistic surrogacy as a gift to overcome infertility by people who have a pre-existing relationship is vastly preferable. Clearly preferable to the highly commercialized version where you know, hire your gamete donors from a catalogue and then use a middle broker to find a woman somewhere who's willing to rent out her womb to you. I think it's, let alone reproductive tourism on an international scale, it's clearly preferable, though I think it still doesn't resolve all of the concerns that we would have. For instance, you are still fundamentally breaking apart conception and childbirth and procreation, because this child will be born with two mothers, you know, at least two mothers. If the initial first sister is infertile for different reasons, she might not even be able to donate an egg. So you could potentially have three mothers: the donor of the egg, the sister whose womb carries the child, and the other sister who intends to raise the child. And what we increasingly know is what social science studies, psychology studies, child development experts have learnt, often by studying children who've been adopted, is that children who are not raised by their birth family experience trauma, experience harm from that. Even astonishingly, even if children have been removed from birth, from their birth parents, and never met them, have no relationship with them, simply coming to learn as they grow up that they are not living with their birth parents does cause and can cause psychological trauma and harm. And that only underlines the kind of philosophical argument that Schaefer is making. It's kind of evidence, isn't it, that actually separating out parenthood and every and in this scenario, the even if they're sisters, fundamentally the surrogate mother is going to hand over this child that she raised in her womb for 9 months to another person to raise, is, I think, is still loading too much potential harm onto the child who cannot choose any of this.
And it's interesting. I mean, it's often been pointed out that in those early chapters of Genesis, Abraham undertakes a kind of surrogacy.
Yeah.
You know, famously he's desperate Hagar, to have an heir. With Hagar, yeah, he's desperate to have an heir. And the idea is that he'll have intercourse with Hagar, and then she'll produce a son, and then that son will be welcomed in to the family and become the heir. And of course, the whole purpose of the narrative is to point out that actually this ends up as a disaster, and it creates all kinds of complex issues, and even the conflict between Jews and Arabs, can be traced to
supposedly
an act of reproductive primitive reproductive technology.
Yeah. And as you say, the driving purpose of that narrative is to condemn Abraham for his lack of trust in God, who had promised him a child through his wife, despite their very great years and their lack of children thus far. And the point, the narrative thrust of that passage is Abraham did not trust God, and so took the power into his own hands rather than submitting himself to the creator who created him and who holds life in his hands, and said, I'm going to solve this problem by myself. And actually doesn't solve the problem at all, creates a whole bunch of other problems. And then you have that beautiful bit where Hagar and Ishmael, forge out into the desert on this kind of suicide march, and are protected and cared for by God, though they are not, this is not the line that will become Israel and is part of God's chosen people. We see God's compassion for the victims of human kind of avarice and arrogance.
Yeah, and so, again, there's a partial issue, isn't it? It's quite possible that there's someone listening to this podcast who has been conceived through surrogacy.
Yes.
And, what does it say about me if my origins are deeply confused and contested and I am uncertain about my own identity?
Yeah. And that's, I think, fundamentally why I would always be hesitant, even in like the best circumstances. I think surrogacy, the children who were born through surrogacy are being given an unwanted heavy burden to carry for the rest of their lives, because their parents thought that they knew better and thought that they could manipulate and control their bodies and in some sense step outside kind of God's creative intentions in the creative world. You want to be hesitant, you want to be compassionate, you want to recognize that the majority of people who do this are people who are suffering through infertility, which is a horrible, horrible experience and deeply painful to not be able to conceive children naturally. And my heart goes out to anyone in that situation. I don't want to stand in judgment and condemnation of people who've made some very difficult decisions out of a very good, earnest desire to have children. But I just think we have to act with humility here and look beyond our own desires and think about every human being, the gamete donors, the surrogates, the middlemen, the brokers, the fathers, and ultimately the children who are born through this process, and think, is this in their best interest, as well as also being what I would like to happen?
Yeah, and so the interesting thing, isn't it, is that the Christian faith, on the one hand, celebrates and emphasises the importance of biological roots, but at the same time, it relativises it and says, OK, these things are important, but they don't define who you are. I mean, many people are conceived in ways that are less than ideal. Yeah. I mean, and the fact that you're a product of some catastrophic event, either whether it was reproductive technology or whether it was non-consensual sex or whether it was some kind of violent, abusive relationship, yeah. that doesn't define who I am. No. I'm defined by, ultimately, by my Heavenly Father. I am who you say I am.
Mm. And there's something mysterious, almost paradoxical, as you say, about the fact that we've said, kind of created order and much of scripture points towards the importance of family ties and of not presuming that human state institutions or technology can kind of ride roughshod over that. And at the same time, the New Testament establishes a new kind of family based not on blood ties to our father Abraham, but on baptism in through water and the Spirit. You know, the new family of God is not simply people who happen to be related to one Near Eastern patriarch thousands of years ago, but anyone is welcome to be adopted. You know, Paul uses that language, to be adopted into sonship. And so there's something complicated for us to untangle here about what we think family is. And it's been remarkable, just to speak personally as a father of an adopted child, how little it matters that my daughter doesn't share any of my DNA, that she's not my blood relative, is really not very important in a philosophical sense. It doesn't change how much I feel or legally am her father, but also in a practical sense, it doesn't really matter that she doesn't look like me or my wife. And that, I think, what a lot of people presume, looking at adoption from the outside, for example, is that it's incredibly difficult to kind of raise a child who's quote unquote not your own. And actually, the truth is quite the opposite.
Yeah, it's a fascinating phenomenon, isn't it? Of the way that the child becomes part of you and part of your heart, irrespective of their genetic origins. And again, this is inevitably, it is a beautiful image within, at the very heart of the Christian faith, isn't it? That God, we don't deserve, we don't belong in any sense in God's family. And yet, through grace, we are treated as though we were children. In every respect, we become heirs and co-heirs with Christ himself.
And that idea of heirs and inheritance is what Paul is driving at when he uses the language of adoption in some of the New Testament. Because the paradigm of adoption in his day, in the kind of classical Greco-Roman world, was very, very different to adoption as it happens today. You know, that what would happen in the Greco-Roman world was would often be someone would be adopted as an adult or as very nearly an adult, as an older teenager, where it would be often a kind of wealthy paterfamilias, maybe someone who didn't have a son or whose son had died or something like that, wanted to find someone to carry on the family name, to take on the family business and the honour and all that kind of stuff. And so they would legally adopt someone as their heir. But it was not done out of kind of humanitarian concern for an orphan, or because the state had intervened to remove a child from their birth parents due to neglect or abuse. It was radically different. And so what Paul is driving at theologically is that we are adopted in to become co-heirs with Christ, which means that we receive the same inheritance he did, even though we don't deserve it. We haven't earned it. And I think while that is a rich and important spiritual vision, it sometimes caused confusion for modern-day Americans, modern-day Christians, but particularly, I think, among American evangelicals who have become very pro-adoption, something I obviously celebrate. But I think sometimes the theology gets a bit muddled and we start to think that the adoption we're doing now, which is overwhelmingly of children who are adopted because they cannot be, as young children, sometimes even from birth, because they either cannot or will not be raised by their birth family. And it's kind of humanitarian reasons. It sometimes gets problematic when we start to conceive of, oh, we've adopted these children out of sin, just like we've been adopted out of sin. Do you see what I'm saying? I think sometimes I find it like a little frustrated how people sometimes muddle the theological reasoning and conflate these two adoptions, which are actually taking place for quite different reasons.
Yeah, I understand. So I think just drawing these things to a close, I think it is, however, very helpful to end up on about adoption, isn't it? Because as a Christian response, it does seem to me such a profoundly positive and life-affirming response. You know, whereas reproductive technology always has this element of creating a child according to my will, this child is a product of my will. I am choosing, I'm commodifying a child. However much I try to resist that, it's something intrinsic within the technology. At least there's always that risk. Whereas the very nature of adoption is that there is already a child, that this child exists, this child is in the world, and adoption is a response to not to a creating a child, but to an existing child, an act of grace rather than an act of creation.
And this, in my experience, creates this kind of paradoxical, bittersweet underlying note to adoption, which is that it is a wonderful, redemptive, as you say, an act of grace for the adopters to be able to welcome this child as a gift into their family, to be able to give them the stability and the love and the nurture and care that they otherwise wouldn't be receiving. And yet at the same time, you have to hold that intention with, but this is also kind of a tragedy because this child should be with their birth family. That is what is best for them. That is what was supposed to happen. And what we are doing is trying to repair a breach, a breakdown, a fracturing of the familial bond that was supposed to happen. And we can do the best we can, and we can welcome and love and celebrate this child and all they bring to our family. But we also know fundamentally that it's also quietly sad that they're not with the parents they're supposed to be. And that kind of prevents that, I think, a kind of crowing, overly, naively kind of celebratory aspect to adoption that I sometimes detect in some church circles, which sees it as a kind of unmitigated good thing rather than a kind of an act of redemptive grace that always carries in it a seed of sadness.
Yeah, yeah, fascinating. In other words, that the adopted child always carries this deep wound of brokenness because of the rupture that happened early in their life. But as you say, I mean, this is a phenomenon of redemption, isn't it? That this is where redemption is different from creation. Redemption always involves suffering. It involves brokenness. It involves loss. It isn't a simple quick fix. There you are. Let's pretend it never happened. Redemptive grace is bringing back from out of the darkness a treasure, whilst recognizing that the darkness is real and damaging.
And that's why, you know, all the evidence shows that it's not wise or kind or compassionate to try and erase the adopted child's life story and their entire background before they were adopted. And, you know, again, I see some Christians who kind of revel in the fact that they've changed the child's name and they say, you know, isn't this a picture of how we've been saved from our old self and brought into new life? But actually, the compassionate response is to say that no, actually, this child will always have two sets of parents. And there's a set of parents that they live with and who love and raise them, but they also have a set of parents, their birth parents. And that parenthood is not the same, it's not equivalent, but it should and cannot be erased. And we shouldn't wipe away and try and pretend we started with a blank slate, that this child didn't come from somewhere. This child doesn't carry, as you say, that kind of primal trauma of being separated from their birth family. Even if this is necessary for their own safety and protection, that's still a trauma. And I think it's important that we kind of, as adoptive parents, take the painful step of saying, you know, I would love it if this was a kind of cleaner, simpler story, but it's not. You know, my daughter has another father in the world somewhere, and I cannot try and erase his claim to fatherhood, nor should I, you know, not tell my child anything, you know, at an age appropriate sense about their backstory and where they come from, because that is part of their story, part of their life, part of what belongs to them. Redemption, as you say, doesn't pretend that the grief and the loss never happened. It just restores the back to something closer to God's original intention, but without obliterating how things had broken in the first place.
Yeah, profound again stuff. Maybe we should draw these things to a close. I suppose I just want to reflect on the fact that redemption in Christian thinking, although it always involves this mix of suffering and glory, of pain and joy, ultimately, in the Christian story, redemption leads to a greater good. Mm. It leads to new and wonderful realities which were not there in creation. And it's just interesting to speculate about that. Do you think there's some sense in which, by being now rooted in a community of believers, something new and positive can come into the life of all children who are brought up in a believing family within a believing community, but also for those who've been adopted?
Yeah, I think that must be the case. I think, as you say, these are kind of deeply mysterious things. You know, why is it that the resurrected Jesus in his glorious resurrection body still has visible scars and a hole in his side? You know, it's strange, mysterious that Jesus, as at his most glorified, at his, you know, completion, as he ascends into heaven to sit at the right hand of the Father forevermore and prepare a place for us, is still wounded and carries some of the brokenness and the finitude and the flaws of his incarnate self pre-death. And I think there's something mysterious about, yeah, maybe it is better for children to be adopted into a home which is, you know, one in which they will be introduced to Jesus, if that wouldn't have happened in their birth family. But I mean, it becomes so messy and difficult to try and disentangle the various losses and gains, advantages, disadvantages. I think at some point you have to step back and say, thank goodness there is a creator God, the ultimate father of every child on earth, their spiritual father, who knows and sees all things and who holds children, as we know from the Gospels, very, very close to his heart. And ultimately, whatever the state and social workers and various Christian systems are doing, I think I step back and say, our own story is that we believe from the moment of her conception, our daughter was known and loved and seen by her Father God. And even through her complicated upbringing thus far, there is one constant of security and one constant good, which is that she has been known and loved and seen by her spiritual father, who was there at every stage in foster care, in the hospital, through adoption, through court hearings, and will be there throughout the future as well, even when her new adoptive parents fail, as we inevitably do on a daily basis. And I think that is what you have to rest on as we're trying to kind of chart a path through the messy and brokenness we've made as human beings of raising and having children.
Yeah, wow. Profound stuff, Tim. Thank you. I agree.
Right. Should we draw a conversation to a close there? We've kind of meandered in a slightly strange way, but we do recommend you go and read the piece by Schaefer, the essay, which we kind of sparked a conversation. It's a little philosophical in some of its language, a little dense, but it's worth persevering with, and it makes quite a compelling case about some of the things we should be alarmed about how our technology and our and this law and the state are getting uncomfortably entangled in children and families. So we'll link to that below. We'll also link to a previous episode we did a few years ago about surrogacy, which was kind of prompted by some potential reforms to the regulations here in the UK, which I think dealt more kind of concretely on our views on surrogacy and Christianity and that kind of thing. And of course, there's lots more about reproductive technologies and infertility. It's a topic we come back to quite regularly on Matters of Life and Death. So do look at John's dad's website, johnwyatt.com, which has got more on that. We'd love to know your own thoughts, particularly if you're someone who has experienced infertility, if who has been born through surrogacy, who is considered or has conceived children through surrogacy. We'd love to know your own thoughts, your disagreements. What have we missed? What do we not understand? Where have we got it wrong? Do get in touch with us by email. You can email molad@premier.org.uk. But otherwise, we'll be back next week with another episode. And until then, bye-bye.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.